Well, you're all extremely welcome to the London School of Economics and on this Human Rights Day to an event which is being laid on by the Centre for the Study of Human Rights here at the LSE, of which I'm director, Conor Geertie, and also I'm delighted to be able to say by the BBC World Service Trust Project. This is a global education project developed by the BBC World Service Trust, 102 hours of radio programs in 25 languages, plus a website, plus international awareness-raising events and debates. And I have to say that at the LSE we are, and at the Centre particularly, extremely pleased to be associated with such a tremendous venture. It being Human Rights Day, the Secretary General of the United Nations issued a message and emphasized, above any other things in his message, the need for respect for the international rule of law. And during these difficult times, it's worth, I think, just saying exactly what the Secretary General said. The strength of the rule of law lies in its universal relevance and application. In its grounding in the fundamental human rights of all people, it applies equally to the strong and to the weak. Its application is the duty of states, large and small. It is the most effective tool to fight criminality and terrorism, and the best guarantee of safety, security, and freedom for us all. And then Mr. Annan appeals to all governments, communities, and individuals to recommit themselves to the universal application of the rule of law. And I think this linkage between human rights and international rule of law is well judged. And it's in the context of that message and of the day, Human Rights Day, that the Centre is extremely proud, together with the BBC, to be able to provide this platform for Hina Jilani, her first visit to the LSE. Hina will be well known to you, many of you, as the Special Representative of the Secretary General on the situation of human rights defenders. She's also a founding member of the Human Rights Commission of Pakistan, of which I gather she's currently Secretary General. She's been an advocate, still is, in the Supreme Court of Pakistan, fighting for persons whose rights have been violated, victims of domestic violence, fundamentalist violence, bonded workers, and victims of honor killings. She's also set up and currently runs the largest free legal aid center in Pakistan, the AGHS Legal Aid Cell, which focuses on women and promotes legal awareness, education, protection from exploitation, legal research, counseling, and legal assistance. Now, of course, somebody of this stature has not only deservedly been appointed to this difficult post, Special Representative, but has also received the Amnesty International Jeannette Sagan Award for Women's Rights and the UNIFEM Millennium Peace Prize for Women. So I really don't think we could have somebody on Human Rights Day who more clearly and powerfully symbolizes what it means to promote and protect human rights during these turbulent times. And the lecture title, which you will know, is extraordinarily apposite: Protecting Human Rights in an Anti-Terrorist World. Hina will speak for a little while, and then there'll be an opportunity for questions and comments, together with answers, and the reward for your diligence will be access to a drinks reception afterwards. But as you will know, in accordance with my normal practice, I don't reveal the location of the drinks until the conclusion of the event. I come from, as I said last time, a culture where everybody would leave if they had any indication of where the drink was, and I'm maligning the Irish, but I'm allowed to do that. So without further ado, I would like you all to welcome Hina Jilani to the LSE in the traditional fashion.
Mr. Chairperson, ladies and gentlemen, good evening. I would like to begin by thanking the Center for the Study of Human Rights and the BBC World Service Trust for inviting me to speak on the occasion to mark the adoption of the Universal Declaration of Human Rights. As has just been said, this is my first time at LSE, and when I came here and spoke to and just met Connor, I told him that it was an honor for me to be here, and he thought it wasn't that much of an honor, but I told him that he doesn't know how much I've been wanting to come to LSE. So I see this as a privilege to be able to speak to people from an institution which I have always seen as one where the environment is so vibrant, intellectually so vibrant, that any topic that we discuss, I'm sure, will be received not only in the context of what we talk about this evening, but this will go beyond what we talk about this evening, and more thought will come out of what is said this evening and what is discussed this evening. I think it is rather significant that 54 years later, after the adoption of the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, the human rights discourse should be dominated by the fear of serious erosion of principles and norms for which the Universal Declaration stands. In the decades following the Declaration, numerous human rights treaties, conventions, and instruments were adopted to lay down standards and safeguards to protect a broad spectrum of rights, civil and political, as well as economic, social, and cultural rights. Yet, today, we are discussing whether the discourse of human rights is at a critical point. And in so discussing, we are examining the role of the civil society and the ways in which human rights NGOs can maintain their influence in a very difficult climate. I would like to speak about that climate and then draw your attention to the environment and the conditions within which the work for the promotion and protection of human rights is being done, and how those who are doing this work are faring at the hands of governments as well as non-government entities who are responding to what we call the post-September 11th environment. Events of September 11th in New York have triggered off trends that have, on the one hand, raised the most serious concerns regarding international peace and security, and on the other, expose the vulnerability of human rights and the commitment to respect them. I think it is important for us to realize that the threat to security has not only come from the acts of terrorism. The threat to security has also come from the responses to these acts. And people all over the world are today experiencing the consequences of terrorist acts as well as the responses. And these consequences are political instability, social tensions, and the fear and threats of further conflicts in the world. It is important to remember that it was precisely to provide minimum standards under the most extreme emergencies that many of the international human rights and humanitarian laws were agreed upon between nations. And these were agreed upon in the face of threats to security. But now, these standards are being disregarded as having no application in times of emergencies. There is no argument with the premise put forward that it is the duty of the international community and governments world over to take steps to restore and maintain public confidence in domestic and international security. Nevertheless, there is an equally paramount responsibility of states to observe the principles of human rights and the standards established by the legal and normative instruments in the field of human rights. Imperatives of peace and security must be served in a manner that they complement the obligation to do justice. Human rights cannot be ignored in the face of security, and security cannot be promised outside the rule of law. It would appear, however, that the widespread sense of insecurity and fear that the attacks on September 11th have generated internationally and within countries, and have given rise to a climate in which legislatures, judiciaries, and the public in general are increasingly less vigilant in their scrutiny of the actions or acts of omission of their respective governments. I would like to refer here to the preamble of the Declaration on Human Rights Defenders, adopted by the United Nations in 1998, which recognizes the relationship between international peace and security and the enjoyment of human rights, but is also mindful that that the absence of peace and security does not excuse non-compliance. There are several examples that we can quote from different instruments of human rights to enforce the recognition that human rights and commitment to the respect for human rights cannot suffer a reversal at the first sight of adversity. I would now like to speak a little bit about the concept of security, and how those active in the field of human rights have been striving for a long time to change the traditional notions of security and to develop the concept of security as an alternative to the state-created concept of national security, which is rooted in the military security and defense domain. This endeavor of the human rights community was to redefine security in terms of human rights, in terms of human security, in terms of security which comes from the enjoyment of rights, from the enjoyment of peace, and from the hope and prospects of development. This is also a concept of security which was advanced through the UN. And many of the, especially I'd like to mention the UNDP Human Development Report of 1994, which put forward this concept of security and defined it less as defending territory and more in terms of protecting people. I'm afraid efforts to promote this concept of human security has suffered a setback. Instead, there are rising concerns that as a result of the September 11th events, approaches to solving international problems based on the rule of law will give way to approaches that are security driven. This occasion was used to justify further militarization of society and curtailment of civil liberties. Growing militarization has usurped the resources needed to even begin to fulfill the promises of advancing human security. That is, I think, one of the most significant victims of the September 11th events. I would here also stop for a minute and speak about the general notion that the world changed after 11th September. I'm afraid a lot of heartburn emanates from this notion. Was September 11th the redefining moment? For many people all over the world, it was not. Terrorism is not a new phenomenon. People all over the world suffered from acts of terrorism. People all over the world suffered from trends that led to violence, to intolerance on the basis of religion or ethnic differences. Special victims of these negative trends and those who suffered the worst impact were women, minorities, whether religious or ethnic, children who were used as a fodder for wars spurred by a sense of religious extremism. So let us not talk about September 11th as when it all began. It began a long time ago, my friends. I come from a region where what happened on September 11th was predicted by human rights advocates 20 years ago. And in what context were they predicting it? They were predicting it in the context of strategies and policies employed by the very international community that is today allies in the war on terrorism. These were the policies as a part of the anti-Cold War strategies. And I would like to remind you of 1979 and the decade of the 80s. When the Soviet Union had occupied Afghanistan. These were the very forces who, in their wisdom, thought that creation of religious frenzy was essential in that part of the world to create a force imbued with religious zest and fervor to go into Afghanistan and fight the Soviets. Yes, in some ways, it was a strategy which worked. But what was the fallout of that? Did the international community think at that time that the creation of this religious frenzy would be only one step short of creating international terrorism. Much before this particular form of terrorism emerged, people in that region started experiencing how, in order to fight and resolve an international conflict, human rights of the people, not only in Afghanistan, but in the surrounding areas, were traded off. Human rights advocates in that region, at that point, became the target of governments who were at that time promoting religious extremism in a manner which affected their own populations. Pakistan, for instance, the military government that had come into existence in 1977 suddenly brought in an agenda of Islamization. Discriminatory legislation against women, against non-Muslim minorities, and policies, very aggressive policies, of punishing those who dissented against such discrimination, became of everyday use. For various political reasons, even when the Soviets left Afghanistan, certain forces and certain trends were still promoted there, and people's human rights were still ignored. Now, I'm only deviating from the subject because the relevance of this is how the international community reacts to crises and emergencies. In the short term, there may be visible some success, but in the longer term, human rights will always suffer. Did we think about the women in Afghanistan and the rights of women in Afghanistan when the notion of jihad was promoted? Today, the war against terror, in fact, is being justified very much and being given a moral high ground because of the rights of women in Afghanistan. I would like to touch upon the situation that has been created now in the aftermath of September 11th. From a more political point of view, and how that situation is posing a very difficult challenge for human rights defenders. What do human rights defenders stand for? Human rights defenders stand for the right to dignity. Human rights defenders stand for the right to civil and political rights, enjoyment of civil and political rights. Human rights defenders stand for the enjoyment of social, economic, and cultural rights. They strive for these rights. However, for them, this is a cause which must be promoted in a manner that is non-violent, in a manner that does not destroy peace, but rather builds peace. They can therefore never be a part of any process that promotes violence or violent means. They are in fact standing always on the side which promotes tolerance, which promotes non-discrimination, which mainstreams the more marginalized communities and ensures that those on the fringes of the society are not left out either from the processes of democracy or from the sharing of resources and have a voice in making sure that at the national, regional and international level, decisions are made which promote the interests of all and do not in any way expose some to the exploitation of others. In the context of religious extremism, human rights defenders have been targeted both by government and non-state entities who have had an agenda which they promoted through the political use of religion. At the same time, I think it is important for us to remember that there has to be a distinction. On the one hand, between those who have a cause and those who have an agenda, which is something that I intend to come back to later on. There is also an important distinction between the responsibility of governments and states for the actions that they commit and the way that we view or deal with actions of non-state entities. Human rights defenders, especially in the present current context, have been targeted and have been attacked for criticizing responses of governments and not being as or are seen as not being as vociferous against those who are perpetrating acts of terror. Human rights defenders are as conscious as anybody else about the imperatives of security. They are as conscious of the effects and consequences that these acts of terrorism are having on populations all over the world. Nevertheless, states have a responsibility to act within the rule of law. I think it is also important to mention here that measures taken in the name of war against terrorism, be they legislations, policies, or strategies that have been adopted by governments, are fast undermining human rights and fundamental freedoms. Governments and states are obliged to fulfill their international commitments. They are not only responsible, they are accountable for any abuse of human rights and violations that they commit. And as I said earlier, many of the measures that we are studying today, and as Special Representative on Human Rights Defenders, the information that I am receiving, have no relevance to the safety and security either of the state or its people. And many of these measures are destroying the very core values of human rights. This is being done in a manner, what is most worrisome, that these violations of human rights, even of those rights and freedoms which are non-derogable, even in the state of dire emergencies, these rights cannot be taken away. Today, they are being taken away and there is silence. It is this silence that worries me. It worries me because I could have seen this post-September 11th environment and scenario as a challenge, as a time to rethink, to revive the debate on human rights standards, and to give more vibrancy to this debate in the face of threat, and to start off and perhaps strengthen these values, if only as a resistance to the threats that they are facing. As a human rights activist, I know that the best movements that we have been able to revitalize or to give birth to have been in the face of resistance. Nevertheless, if there is no resistance, there is no space for optimism for people like us. And it is this silence, in fact, that frightens me. It also frightens me in the face of another trend. And that trend is that multilateral approaches to solving international conflicts are fast surrendering to unilateral approaches in which interests of more powerful states are overriding the rule of law and respect for human rights. I feel that there is very little benefit or usefulness in naming countries. But it is important to realize that today, an environment has been created essentially through the acts of one particular government, which has given an excuse to other governments to exacerbate their own tendencies for violations of human rights and to justify what was happening even before September 11th. Many governments had adopted security legislations. Many governments had adopted measures and policies and practices that were violating human rights. But they always felt that there is scrutiny of their practices, and that at some point and at some level there is a process of accountability. Today, that very meager obstruction that they felt for the violation of human rights is removed. I'm rather surprised, well, not surprised, but I've always wondered why governments are so slow to copy good practices, and why are they so quick to copy conduct, behavior, and practices which is violative of human rights, and in many ways negative in terms of the promotion and protection of democracy, human rights and peace. What are the trends that we are seeing today? I'm starting to keep a list of countries who pass national security or anti-terrorist legislation. I started doing this in December 2001. The list has grown so fast. I wish that the list of countries that ratify international instruments grew that fast. What kind of anti-terrorism legislation are we looking at? This is legislation that is destroying all accepted norms in the field of due process, in the field of fair trials. These are legislations which are giving governments the power to arrest and detain without charges for unacceptably long periods. And I'm talking about several countries. I'm not talking about a few countries which you can count on your fingertips. Several countries. Writs of habeas corpus are being refused. Judiciaries have lost their independence. The only thing that you need to do is to declare a person as a terrorist and then refuse to present any evidence to that effect in any court of law. And this is not happening only with respect to arrest and detention. I am sorry to say that we are seeing today a trend where unilateral declarations are made against people of being terrorists and extrajudicial killings are being done with impunity. And these trends, in many ways, indicate to us, are they indicating to us, that the concept of human rights is changing? That what has evolved over decades for the protection of the right to life, is that changing? Are all the protections which were designed in order to give people and the protection and to guarantee the right to life, the right to liberty, the right to personal security, and above all, the right to dignity? Are all these in some ways going to change because a new war has come into existence? We have all grappled with the benefits and the damages of globalization. Today, war is also globalized. And similarly, depending on where we are and from where we come, we are looking at the gains and losses of this globalization of war. I would like to also here remind you that the global political environment after 11 September has become especially dangerous for those who are standing up for one of the most fundamental rights of all, the right of peoples to self-determination. People's inalienable right to self-determination is a fundamental cornerstone of human rights law. As well as being among the foundations of one of the United Nations' principal purposes. Self-determination not only features in Article 1 of the Charter of the United Nations, but also in the first article of both the international covenants. According to the General Comment 12 adopted in 1984 by the Human Rights Committee, the realization of all peoples' inalienable right to self-determination, and I quote here, is an essential condition for the effective guarantee and observance of individual human rights and for the promotion and strengthening of those rights. In the post-11 September climate, where human rights defenders peacefully campaigning for and advocating the realization of all people's right to self-determination are under renewed and sustained attack worldwide, it seems particularly poignant to recall also another general comment of the Human Rights Committee. General Comment 11 on Article 20 of the International Covenant on Civil and Political Rights, prohibiting war propaganda and incitement to national, racial, and religious hatred. In that general comment, adopted in 1983, the Human Rights Committee stated, "The provisions of Article 20, paragraph 1, do not prohibit advocacy of the right of peoples to self-determination and independence in accordance with the Charter of the United Nations." Today, in this current climate, upholding human rights and fundamental freedoms is being portrayed in a number of countries as a threat to national and international security. Against this stark reality, human rights defenders are finding themselves under siege. Peaceful pro-independence activists are being portrayed as disseminators of propaganda likely to harm the state, as a threat to national security, as attempting to overthrow the government, and as aiding and abetting terrorism. While spuriously equating legitimate and peaceful advocacy of the right to self-determination with terrorism, however defined, is not a new phenomenon. It is certainly assuming a greater resonance. And human rights defenders working for the realization of people's quests for self-determination are experiencing some of their darkest hours. In this context, I would just like to draw your attention so that I'm able to clarify what human rights defenders are today facing. I have spoken about measures that governments have taken in terms of adopting laws, in terms of adopting policies, in terms of practices. I'm sorry, I should also mention another one. When I speak about non-derogability of human rights, certain fundamental freedoms, the foremost amongst them, after the right to life, is protection against torture. What is happening today? In many countries, the kind of policies that are being undertaken, more and more emphasis is being given to secrecy, and therefore incommunicado detentions, and therefore refusal to give access to information. But more than anything else, refusal to even let people know who has been arrested, where they are being detained. This is apart from the fact that no charges are ever brought against people. Now, this kind of a situation in many of the countries where there are already fears that torture is regularly used creates greater concerns with regard to the safety and security of those who are arrested. I have even received information which, if confirmed, I think is a matter not only of worry but of shame. And that is that countries who don't want to dirty their own hands are extraditing people to third countries to make it possible for use of torture against them. I think these are pieces of information that people are investigating, and so far there is strong indication that these are true. Other procedures, for instance, extraditions. There is a fundamental principle of human right that you do not extradite people to countries where they could either be subjected to torture or to cruel and inhuman or degrading treatment, or indeed many countries even do not extradite people to countries where there could be a death penalty. It's not just that standards are being lowered. No standards are being followed. There are extraditions without any judicial process, which amount to abductions from one country to another. And these are done by the connivance of intelligence agencies of more than one country. And this is what human rights defenders are fighting against. What are they asking? Human rights defenders are emphasizing that peace and security can only be achieved through strengthening of human rights and not through undermining human rights. Human rights defenders are only seeking to protect the more vulnerable categories of citizens and those who are non-citizens, the migrants, the asylum seekers, those who are living on the fringes of society. This is the work that they are doing. They are seeking redressal for governmental oppression in denying people fair trial and due process. And for this, there is a smear campaign against human rights defenders. And I have received information, not from one country, and this is why I find this so worth mentioning, how countries even copy each other's terminology, that human rights defenders who are criticizing acts which violate fundamental human rights and lower the standards of human rights, they are being called friends of terrorists. They are not just being called friends of terrorists. Action is being taken against them. People have been arrested. People have been detained without trial. In the case of one particular human rights activist regarding whom I received information. Initially, when he was arrested, his case went to the court. The court accepted the petition challenging his detention, asked for his production, withdrew that order on the reminder of the state council in that case, that it could affect the war on terrorism. Withdrew the writ of habeas corpus that had already been issued. So it's not just how governments are responding. These trends are serious because maybe at some point these legislations will be reversed. Maybe they will be reviewed. But the damage that they do cannot be that easily reversed. The damage that they do is to the institutions, which are critical in terms of their role for the promotion and protection of human rights. And once we lose the strength of these institutions to perform their role, nothing stands between the powerful state and the vulnerable citizen. States will adopt measures today against what they call terrorists. But these are the very measures which are going to be used against those who exercise their fundamental right to expression, who exercise their fundamental right to assembly, who exercise their right to call into question and to criticize governmental policies and conducts. Normal forms of civil disobedience, my friends, are today being criminalized by legislation coming into existence everywhere in the world. To give you one example, a protest demonstration by peasants protesting against action of the government denying them land tenure, members of this protest demonstration were charged under the anti-terrorist laws. These are examples that we are hearing every day from every country. I think in this context, it becomes extremely important that we think back, that the human rights community sits down to review the responses, and instead of going on the defensive in responding to very aggressive attacks against human rights defenders that they are either naive and do not understand what needs to be done in the name of security, or are essentially, like in the terms employed against human rights defenders, are defending terrorists, we need to sit up and we need to assert that these are values for which the international community has fought hard and fought long. And these are not values that we can either allow or afford to be reversed. The United Nations, for instance, how did that respond to the situation? The former High Commissioner for Human Rights, Mary Robinson, in a joint statement with the European Union and the OSCE, warned of these very trends. In very early after September 11th, 17 of the special rapporteurs of the Commission on Human Rights, including myself, made a joint statement emphasizing that in this situation of crisis, there is all the more reason that human rights should be strengthened, that human rights should be used for better security, and to show to those countries who have never accepted human rights standards or claimed them, that human rights do have illegitimacy and that they do have a genuine effect on peace and security. This is the response of the UN. The UN also passed, the Security Council of the United Nations passed a resolution asking governments to make a report on what kind of anti-terrorist measures that they have taken. This resolution also set up a counter-terrorism committee, which would be reviewing the responses and reports of the government. One of the suggestions was that this committee should be advised by human rights experts, so that the measures that governments are reporting should be studied with a heightened human rights sensitivity. The committee, however, declined to set up this kind of an expertise within the committee. Nevertheless, one of the positive things was the guidelines that the committee has been given by the Office of the High Commissioner on what kind of questions should be posed to governments with regard to their anti-terrorism measures. And these are questions which ensure that none of these measures can continue or can be sustained if they are violating human rights and are abusive of the standards of human rights contained in international instruments. I would like to conclude by quoting from a statement made by the Secretary General of the United Nations on this issue. And I quote, "We should all be clear that there is no trade-off between effective action against terrorism and the protection of human rights. I believe that in the long term, we shall find that human rights, along with democracy and social justice, are one of the best prophylactics against terrorism. Terrorism is a weapon for alienated, desperate people and often a product of despair. If human beings everywhere are given more hope of achieving self-respect and a decent life by peaceful methods, terrorists will become much harder to recruit and will receive far less sympathy and support from society at large." Thank you, ladies and gentlemen.
Thank you very, very much, Hina Jamani. I guess in some ways it ought to be a day of celebration, but I think it's right to have such a sharp reminder of how fundamental the threat to the language of human rights is. You wonder what normality actually means now when you talk about normal civil liberties. And you think about the struggle for human rights. What perhaps flickering across some of our minds was whether or not that struggle might end in relative failure. It's not inevitable that human rights continue to be guaranteed. We have some time, we have a good few minutes for questions. Those who have been here before know that they should now have put their hands up, which two people have, rather cleverly, three. What I would like to do is, I would like to take people in series and then go back to Hina. What already a large number of people have indicated that they want to speak. I really would ask you, firstly, to wait for the microphone to arrive. Some people's most brilliant questions are heard only by themselves. And then, when it arrives, remember that it should be turned on. Equally brilliant questions are posed with microphones that are not functioning. And then, secondly, please provide both your name and where you are from, unless you'd very much prefer not to, which is fine. The kind of comment you make is one that you'd like to make anonymously, but please do if you feel able to. Thirdly, perhaps even more importantly, please keep the intervention, whether it be a comment or a question, relatively short. There's well over 250 people here, upstairs and downstairs, so each minute used by you is a minute that we take from somebody else. So try and be concise. There's a lady here, there's a gentleman here, and there's this lady here, and we'll take these three at the start. And then we're going upstairs.
My name is Juliana, and I work in Ramallah, Palestine. Palestinian territory is occupied by Israel. My question is, in countries under occupation, human rights defenders need to be there, and it's not only that the state apparatus of your own will be upset about it, but it's the occupier. So what people like in our circumstance, our colleagues who work for local NGOs are not international NGOs that they can have the visas and everything. They are in a vulnerable situation because they have to be there as long as the occupier would provide them tourist visas. So my question is, if there anybody or any place that these kind of people can go and complain once they are kicked out of their duties. And the second question is, when the UN is going to send human rights observers on the ground in Palestine? Because it's been the longest occupation in history, and it's thinking of sending only humanitarian voice to go there and minimize the things, right, distribution, medication. It's not going to solve the problem. The problem is freedom of movement and all these things. So when the UN, even illegally, or when they're going to find a way of informal, or what kind of creative solution they could find to do something about it? Thank you.
Thank you. And we're going to hold you for a moment, Tina, if I may. This gentleman right in the center, to whom a microphone is being briskly passed. I said hopefully. Excellent.
My name is Shahid Qureshi. I work for Frontier Post. It's a Pakistani-based newspaper. I'm their correspondent in London. My question to Ms. Jilani is that, do you think that the UN has failed to protect the rights of the human beings on this earth in the last 50 years? I mean, I'll take the example of Rwanda, Bosnia, Palestine, and your neighboring country, Kashmir. And in all these cases, you'll see the largest democracies are involved in the worst human rights violations, as your comment about the military and the religious extremism you mentioned. But in these cases, the largest democracies are involved, and those countries are involved who beat the drum of democracy and make a mockery out of it by violating itself. Thank you.
Thank you very much. And we have a lady at the front here, and then we're going to Hina, and then we're going to go upstairs.
Thank you very much for the stimulating talk. I have two very quick questions. The first one, in the course of your talk, you made a distinction between those who have a cause and those who have an agenda. Could you kindly elaborate on that point? And the second question is, like, while what is called terrorism today, or the fanning of religious extremism, has its roots in the Cold War era by certain countries against other countries during the Cold War era, and the fact that terrorism undermines the basic rights of the vulnerable groups in those countries itself, what is your comment on the fact that there has to be some kind of a political support from the local communities? Otherwise, who are called the jihadis, oblique, who are called the terrorism by others. How can it continue without some kind of a local political support? And if there is local political support, then are these people brainwashed, or are they convinced that this is the only way to a different form of development, or the creation, or a move away from the capitalist globalization that is going on? Or, is there must be some kind of a convincing. And what is your comment on those? Thank you.
Thank you. This is beginning to resemble a tough PhD viva, yes. But we'll
I think these are very tough questions, but I will try and answer them, not as a representative of the Secretary General of the United Nations, but as a human rights defender myself. And I hope that the audience understands that these are comments that I am making as a human rights defender in my experiences as a human rights defender. Even as a special representative, I'm not a part of the UN system. Remember that. I'm an independent expert. I have as many problems with the UN system as you may have. The only thing is I have to grapple with it every day of my life, trying to do the job that I do better than I can do it. Now, you were raising the question of where do you complain in the first place about the situation of human rights defenders in terms of travel restrictions, in terms of obstructions that are placed in the way of their monitoring and having access to information with regard to human rights violations. One is my humble self. There are United Nations mechanisms. Whatever degree of effectiveness they have is another question altogether. But there are these mechanisms. And I think that the more they are used, the more political visibility they will have. And this political visibility is very essential for United Nations mechanisms. So make all the complaints that you can. I can assure you that most of the special procedures try their best to respond in a way that at least has some effect on governments. And I know that many doors have opened to human rights defenders after such communications, concerns have been communicated to governments. So that is one very unsatisfactory answer that I can give you. The second is, when will the UN go to Palestine? If you remember, at the Commission on Human Rights, there have been at least two resolutions for independent experts and special rapporteurs to go to Israel. Unfortunately, the UN is an intergovernmental system. The special procedures are dependent on receiving invitations before they can go to a country. These invitations have not only not been extended, they have been refused. Nevertheless, I know for a fact that five of the special rapporteurs that were specially named, the one on extrajudicial killings, the one on torture, and the others, I don't remember, but anyway, there were five, are constantly engaged in making efforts that will allow them to go to Israel. And I can say it on their behalf. I know it personally, that each one of them is making those efforts and continues to make them despite the disappointing and discouraging response from Israel. Now, the question on has the United Nations failed to protect the rights of people? Despite my own reservations regarding the United Nations, my answer is no. While we do look at many for whom the United Nations could not step forward in a timely manner, we should also look at many whom they did save. And let me also say here that in this difficult world, this United Nations maybe is not something to be very excited about, but it is at least the minimum. And I think that that minimum needs to be retained. It needs to be criticized. It needs to be criticized with the intention that this criticism strengthens it. But at the same time, I think it is very important that the United Nations should not be undermined. And today, this institution is as much threatened as human rights are. When I spoke about multilateralism surrendering to unilateralism, the first casualty of that will be the United Nations. So, Mr. Shahid, in our own language, ye ghanimat hai, means this is the minimum. Let's keep it that way. You spoke about the largest democracies today being the most serious violators of human rights. I agree with you. But I'd like to add something. This is from my own experience as a human rights defender. Our biggest mistake has been our laxity in removing the impression that human rights are Western concepts. Human rights are not Western concepts. The right to life, the right to liberty, the right to free, all kinds of freedoms that we see in the international instruments are the very rights that people in my part of the world have fought for centuries. How can I give the sole credit of that to the West? I'm not willing to do it. But at the same time, those who have violated human rights in my part of the world, either in the name of religion or in the name of culture or in the name of tradition, have always attacked human rights advocates as saying that they are promoting ideologies that are Western-oriented. Well, I'm sorry. My right as a woman to be treated in a, you know, equally, my right as a woman to my right to life, my right to liberty, doesn't stem from any Western notion. It stems from my being a human being. I am a part of a very large human rights movement in my own country, which has not been influenced or inspired by the West. It has been inspired by the very things and events that are happening in our own countries. So I think that is one problem, and today we are paying for it. We are paying for it because all those who are violating human rights or were violating human rights earlier on also are today saying, yes, this is the norm. We always said these human rights notions are nonsense. Look, even America is not supporting it. Well, America is not the champion of human rights. No government, no country is. Every country has a good or bad human rights record, but they are not those who should be associated with human rights notions to an extent where when they violate it, the whole notion of human rights changes. That should not be possible. I mean, today, for instance, we have many countries in the world whose human rights record everybody is very conveniently trying to forget because they are allies in the war against terrorism at the cost of democracy. Military governments are being accepted and applauded. Military generals have become the best friends of the democratic states. And we are being convinced, they are trying to convince us that military generals will bring democracies in countries where civil governments have failed to do so. And we are being convinced that that's what's good for us. Now, your question is particularly difficult. When I was talking about cause and agenda, I was essentially pointing towards different phenomena that are going on in the world. And I don't know how to explain it except by being very direct. So I will be direct. For instance, let's talk about violence that stems from, say, the struggle for those who are trying to relieve themselves from the oppressions of occupation. That is violence. And there is no condemnation of violence. Then there is terrorism or acts of terrorism that are perpetrated by, say, Al-Qaeda. I would say here that Al-Qaeda has an agenda, but the Palestinians have a cause. I would not condone violence in either case, but how we deal with that violence will differ, essentially. And that's why I think that distinction has to be there. Don't misunderstand me. I'm a human rights activist. I can never support violence. But I have to make a distinction between these two in order to formulate my own responses to the different, to the violence that occurs because of two different, very different, essentially very different phenomena. This is what I meant. Now, with respect to the brainwashing, I think this is not the time or the place where I can explain this, but let me tell you that it is also a misconception that groups of people who have had a vast political impact or influence necessarily enjoy mass support. In my country, for instance, religious extremism was state-sponsored. Whenever there was a test of popularity through voting, religious parties, and the more extremist ones, were the least likely to come into the parliament or the legislature as a result of voting. Now, of course, things change. And why they are changing is also another question. But let us not presuppose that extremism has always had political support in areas and in regions where this extremism is occurring. They may have had the support of militaries, of intelligence services, of the state many times, but not necessarily of the people.
Thank you very much. I'm saying that people set up certainly deserve a go, and three hands have floated up. This is disproportionate, as the lawyers say. Madam, in the center, yes, no, don't look around you. Yes, and there's a microphone on the way, so you're waiting for the microphone, I'm sorry. And then we have certainly got a lady right at the back, and then we have a gentleman at the front, and we may, I know this gentleman's trying to get in, we'll take these four, but please be very, very succinct, because I do want the reception to occur with some people present. Madam.
I just wanted to ask, in your experience, what steps do you want to see implemented at the international level at the UN to promote and to better protect human rights? Because lately we've all been hearing about anti-terrorism, the need to protect the citizens, and therefore we need to implement these measures. What answers can the human rights protectors or human rights defenders put forward to that? And what practical and effective steps would you like to see in place?
And can you just remind us of who you are?
I was an ex-student of LSE, Gurmeet, and unemployed at the moment.
Well, ex-student of LSE, you know, it's great. thank you. And at the back. Yes, thank you.
I'm Lubna Asif from Pakistan. I'd like to hear your comments about the prisoners on Guantanamo Bay.
Very succinct. And gentlemen, the second row from the front. And then we have you, sir.
Thank you very much. My name's John Benjamin. I'm head of the Human Rights Policy Department at the Foreign Office. I'd like to ask Ms. Jilani if she'd be prepared to be a little bit more specific. She mentioned restrictive anti-terror laws after 9/11. She mentioned extrajudicial killings. She mentioned torture. And she mentioned general repression of human rights defenders. And I wonder if she'd be prepared to give us some concrete examples of the countries which she thinks are the worst perpetrators of those human rights abuses. And I ask particularly because, forgive me if I misheard, I thought I heard you say in response to a questioner that the biggest democracies are the world's worst violators. Forgive me if I misheard, but a statement along those lines I think is an act of gross moral equivocation. I don't think it stands up. I think the worst violators of human rights in this world are not the biggest democracies by any means at all. Thank you.
Thank you very much. And we're going to take the gentleman in the front. And this may well, I regret to say, folks, that we'll have a chance to have further conversations on the margins of the reception, maybe the last formal intervention from the floor. Sir.
I'm Akram Malik from Associated Press of Pakistan. I am the special correspondent based in London. My question is that as you refer in your lecture that there is an emergence of unilateral approach in resolving various problems internationally. If I am allowed I would say resolving problems in a more selective way, because certain problems are being just put aside. My question is that in the emergence of a unilateral approach to resolve the international problems, do you see or do you fear that UN would meet the fate of the League of Nations and would lose its relevance at the end of the day? Thank you.
Thank you very much. We have 3 or 4 minutes for both answers, and Hina also thinking about summing up.
Well, with respect to the question on what can the human rights defenders do in the environment where human rights violations are occurring, I think they're already doing something. After the first shock of both the September 11th attacks and the responses that we experienced, I think human rights defenders are grappling both with the intellectual aspects of the question, as well as in terms of what needs to be done. For instance, I know that the Civil Liberties Union in the United States has, as a project, taken on the identification of people who have suffered arbitrary arrest and detention, those who are still in detention, those who have been denied the right to legal counsel. So these initiatives are emerging, but I think what is the most important initiative that I see is a drawing together of human rights organizations all over the world. And in many ways, encouraging national human rights organizations in countries where these trends are emerging more visibly, so that we can make a partner of them and that they can become the biggest source of lobbying and advocating and pressurizing their own governments. And I would like to say, for instance, in the United States, there is not much of a benefit of organizations outside the United States or human rights defenders outside the United States complaining about what's happening inside the United States. And I'm just using this as an example, that United States is not the only country. There are many others where this is working. So I think it's very important that indigenous human rights movements and national human rights movements become stronger with the support from the outside, so that they take up issues and they use their own public opinion to force their governments to reverse the measures and the strategies which result in human rights violations. Somebody had asked me to comment on the prisoners of Guantanamo Bay. I think a lot has been said about it. Let me very briefly say that there is a general consensus that the incarceration of these persons is violative of human rights and humanitarian law. It will take me a long time to explain the legal intricacies involved here, but there is a deep contradiction in the position of the United States, because you cannot keep anybody in any kind of detention without assigning to them a status. And whichever status is assigned to any detainee, there are rules and regulations within the framework of the rule of law, either at the national or at the international level, which are not being followed in terms of their imprisonment. I wish that we could go into more details on this, because this is a very interesting legal case. As a lawyer, I would have loved to take this on. somebody said that it is unfair to say that the largest democracies are the biggest violators of human rights. I don't think that that was really what was said by the questioner. In the context of what's happening today, it is regrettable that those which are large democracies and have in the past, at least there's been a perception in the past, that their human rights record has been stronger than other countries, are today committing acts which are resulting in human rights violations. And I think that is true. I have enough evidence to share with you, if you like, if we had more time. I have almost 10 or 15 pages of examples of legislations which have been adopted by these democracies and some very non-democratic countries who have very quickly joined the ranks. And I don't think that this evidence can be ignored by us as human rights activists. The unilateral approach and how it's affecting the UN. I don't think that this is the day and age that to expect that the, or fear that the UN will meet the fate of the League of Nations. No, I don't expect that at all. But unfortunately, the faster pace of progress that we were expecting from the UN, and which we have seen, by the way, in the past one decade at least, with the World Conference on Human Rights, with the World Conference on Women, with the World Conference Against Racism. I think the UN is raising with different degrees of success very sensitive human rights questions which need to be discussed. Many issues which were never publicly discussed are today discussed, because from the national level to the regional to the international level at the UN, people have been able to bring this up. I think multilateralism poses a big threat to a just world order, in which the UN may also, to some extent, become a casualty. But it will never be anywhere near what was the fate of the League of Nations. I think just as those who are depending on multilateralism are present in the UN, there are others who are watching out against multilateralism. And I think that we should not close our eyes to the degree of resistance that is being put up to that, including the resistance and the reservation in Europe. Thank you.
I have a feeling that with people like Ina throwing down roots in the international scene, the subject isn't going to be as easy to knock off balance as perhaps some pessimists might have assumed. And it may well be that it's being tested now and that it'll emerge stronger. The Centre has an active speakers program, as you will know. Next term, we return to these important issues in a seminar on terrorism, morality and human rights on the 20th of January. And then we have an entire seminar, you've been to know, Hina, devoted to Guantanamo, a challenge to international human rights on the 13th of February. But we also have Albie Sachs coming, a very distinguished speaker and lawyer and activist from South Africa, on the enforcement of social and economic rights. That's on the 27th of February. And we have a discussion on human rights in Africa on the 13th of March. You don't need to remember the dates because it's all on our website. And also on our website will be details from this lecture and also a transcript in due course of a seminar held this morning at the Centre, which was led by Professor Noam Chomsky from MIT, which was on exactly the same kind of theme. And I really think that all of these functions together can help alert us to the need for our subject to deepen in order to thrive. But I'm sure you'll all agree with me that it's certainly deepened in the hands of Hina Jilani. I know that so many of you wanted to speak, you didn't get a chance, I apologize. The reception is in the Robinson room, which is on the third floor of this building. It ought to be sort of there and available for us. I'm sure I can persuade Hina to wander upstairs for a little refreshment, and we can carry on the discussion, not only with Hina but among ourselves, over a drink in about 2 minutes. But before you go, would you please join with me in both thanking and celebrating the person to whom we have listened this evening.